My name is Bob Darrow, and I am alcoholic. And only through the grace of a God that I was afraid to believe in, that I've accessed and maintained in my life through the 12-step process of the Big Book, an ability to remain reasonably sponsorable, and a persistent and consistent effort in the primary purpose of helping other drunks, I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion altering substance of any kind since October 31st, 1978. And for that, that in and of itself is not the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. My grandfather died with 87 years of sobriety. He never drank. The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is the freedom that we find here, because every alcoholic of my type has had experiences where you quit drinking and you felt like you were doing time until it just overcame you. And it's the freedom from the only thing I ever had to get free from, and that's me, that I found here, that's the real blessing of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank the members of the committee for the privilege of coming here and participating this weekend. I got to see some old friends and meet some new ones, and there's people in this room that have known me for a long time and still like me. It's just remarkable to me. I'm here with the guy who saved my life. He found me in a detox in 1978. He was one of the most active members in Alcoholics Anonymous in the state of Nevada, maybe on the West Coast at the time. He was a delegate. He was elected delegate when Bill was still around. And he was chairman of everything that existed in AA at one time or another. And after he'd done all that, you know what he did? He took meetings into a detox. A man whose life was really full and very good. And he took time out of his life, very busy, full life, a couple times a week to come in and on a fishing expedition that rarely paid off, because under his encouragement, I took meetings back into that same detox until they went out of business for years. And he'd go there week after week, just hoping once in a while you'd catch a guy like me. And those guys gave him their time to do that. And he's sitting here, and he's exuding his humility. I'm giving him enough juice. That's enough. It'll go to his head, really. I want to welcome all the newcomers. Glad you're here. Especially the three guys that came, Shane, Corey, and Ricky? Was it? Richie? Wow. I mean, for God's sakes, do you know where you are? This is... Let me tell you, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, this is a very odd place. First of all, there's not another place on the planet that you'll get a standing ovation and a gift for burning your life to the ground recently. You won't get that at the PTA. You won't get that at Amway. And that's become a habit over the last, I don't know, 30 years. It's a real crowd pleaser to have those new guys come up and get the, I've been to conferences where people are crying and clapping. And the new guy always looks like, oh, he could use a drink. You know? And if you're one of those guys, I hope you've got a sponsor and you're surrounded by people in AA, because I would hate to think that for our own group enhancement that we might have put you guys in a position of danger. That we might have fed something in you that should have been starved. It's not like you're day one. This is not a time in your life you probably want a lot of attention. And if you do, that's another, that's a sickness of another or disorder. I mean, that's, so I just hope you don't leave this room tonight without a sponsor and a bunch of people that'll circle the wagons around you. This is a deadly disease. I am very fortunate to have found you and got far enough in Alcoholics Anonymous to find that there was more here than I ever imagined. And there is. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in an institution. I wasn't even old enough to take a legal drink. And I was in a lot of trouble. I mean, I was in a lot of trouble. There was no doubt in anybody's mind that knew me that I needed something like this. But I'm a hard guy to help. Because I'm one of those kind of guys that I can just destroy all sense of self-worth and self-esteem into me. I can get to a place where I literally loathe myself and hate myself and kind of wish I were dead. And yet I could come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I instantly know I'm smarter than everyone in the room. I fit the old adage, you can always tell an alcoholic, you just can't tell them much. You know, I'm that guy. I don't mean to be that guy, but I'm the guy that sits in the meetings and, you know, the speakers come in and they share their miracle stories. And I don't even hear you. Because I'm just sitting there going, is that a toupee? You know, what? Oh, listen to her. Oh my God, she's a sunbeam for Jesus. You know, I just sit there and I got a mind, I got an ego that does not want to give up the wheel of my ship. And so anything that threatens its control, it will pick apart and it will discount and it will find fault with you. And if it can't find fault, it'll imagine stuff about you. And it's good at that. And so consequently, for many years, nothing gets into me. And the problem is I got too much of me between me and you. I am literally full of myself and my opinions and what I'm right about. I'm dying, but I'm right about a lot. And I don't know what's wrong with me. And I don't want to be an alcoholic. I really, when it says in the beginning of chapter 3 that most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics, oh my God, I'd rather be a mental health case than an alcoholic. I would rather be a drug addict. At least there were rock stars that were drug addicts. There's a little panache in that. But alcoholic, it's a squirmy sounding thing, isn't it? I mean, alcoholic. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. And I got the kind of mind that keeps telling me how I don't got this thing, and I got it. And it doesn't matter. If you're new and you got alcoholism and you don't really think you got alcoholism, it doesn't matter. You still got alcoholism. Right? I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, you can keep telling yourself, my case is... It was funny. Even after years of... several years of multiple treatment centers where I'd seen so many Father Martin movies I could link lip sync to the Chalk Talk. And after years of that, I finally, drinking and failing, I finally got it. Oh, I'm that guy they're talking about. I'm the guy that when I pick up a drink, I got that thing that they talk about where you can't stop. I mean, I finally got that. I never read the book, so couldn't have said allergic reaction or phenomenon of craving. But I understood that from the very first time I ever picked up a drink, every single time I would drink and feel the effect of that alcohol hit me, I would break out in the irresistible yearning for more. I've always had that. I've never not had that. I've never once been in a bar or a party or somewhere and have been doing shots and beers with my buddies for an hour and had the bartender say, hey, Bob, would you like another one? I've never known the experience of sitting there and going, I'm good, thanks, this is good. It's always, yeah, there's only one answer to that question. You want another one? Yeah. Matter of fact, I remember spring break. I went with a bunch of guys up to Boston to a party we'd heard about that was supposed to be really cool, and it really was cool. We were up there, and we were doing shooters and beer bongs and smoking. It was a great party. And some guy, and I'm drinking, and I'm one of those guys, when I drink. And a guy came through the party with a bunch of capsules. I don't even know what they were. But I said, thanks, and took a bunch of them. Well, it turned out to be animal tranquilizer. Well, that's not good. Because in about an hour, I'm laying on the floor, but I'm still conscious. I can't get up, so I'm laying there trying to talk people into bringing me a drink. You know what I'm saying? Because of an allergic reaction to alcohol. Now, that reaction to alcohol differentiates me and sets me apart as a distinct entity. Only people with the disease of alcoholism have that reaction to alcoholism, regardless of what you fancy your real problem is. Whether you think you're really a drug addict or you're a miss potty trained, or if you drink alcohol and you break out an irresistible craving for more, you've got the thing that Silkworth talks about. You're the guy that if you pick up a drink, it's like having sex with a gorilla. You ain't done till the gorilla's done. I mean, you can tell yourself all night long, me and that gorilla are just going to have a dance. No, you're not. No. It's going to be bad. And I got that. And I finally know that I got that. And here's part of the delusion that guys with egos like mine have, is that my ego believes that knowledge is power. It wants power so desperately it thinks. That's why at one point I became a counselor. I was a substance abuse counselor, because I thought with enough knowledge, with enough information, with enough credentials, for God's sakes, I'd be out of the woods. And I was a crackerjack counselor right up to the day I lost the job for being drunk on the job. I mean, drug and alcohol programs don't like that. It doesn't go over well. But I think knowledge is power. So I finally got the knowledge. I'm the guy. I can't take the first drink. And I felt a certain sense of puffed up relief, almost like, yeah, okay, now I'm ready to go. I just don't pick up the first one. I just say no. And I can say no, as most of us can say no, for a sustained period of time. But lack of power is an eventuality for me. See, I can say no. Listen, I'm really grateful to be sober here. No. I'm telling you, no, I ain't smoking nothing either. No. Well, okay, one. And there's a yes in every barrel of no's if you're a guy like me. Sometimes it's on the bottom of the barrel and you got to dig for a while. Other times it's on the top of the barrel. There were times I would go into a detox and I would swear to myself with tears in my eyes, I'm never taking another drink. And I'd drink the day I got out. And other times it would be months, close to a year. Months and months. I had many periods of abstinence. And so I don't understand what's happening to me. What is it? I make up my mind. I mean it this time. And I eventually go back to it. I think that if you're a chronic alcoholic, the type that Silkworth talks about in this book, that this disease will cook you in your own emotional juices until you go insane. It's very much like the way you boil a frog. If you ever had biology classes, I had this biology class, we worked with live frogs. It was kind of weird, actually, very strange. But we worked with dissected live frogs, did things with live frogs. And if you ever tried to boil a live frog, it's just about impossible, because you take a pot of boiling water, and the frog's hind legs are so strong, if you throw it in the boiling water, it'll get scalded like hell, but it will get out of the pot. It'll get out of the pot in bad shape, but it'll get out of the pot. So the only way to really effectively guarantee that you can boil the frog is you got to set him in some room temperature water. He'll just kind of settle in there. It's comfortable. And then if you turn the heat up slow enough, it never realizes what's happening and never jumps out of the pot. And if you don't think that's a good analogy, go to the local detox here and talk to the people who were in there that drank with 5, 10, 15, 20 years of sobriety. And a week before they drank again, they didn't know that alcoholism was having its way with them, because if they would have known, they would have jumped out of the pot. But they didn't know. This is the only disease I know of. If you have it, it uses your own mind against you, which if you're like me, that's a bad deal. Because when I don't feel right, what's the first thing I want to do? Think. I'm a thinker. I just regress up into the control center. Where I just, it's like the bridge of the Starship Enterprise, you know, where I just get up in here and I got the screens and I look out and I got my staff and I go to the AA meetings and I, all right, Scotty, beam that guy to another group. Oh no, she shares again, she's getting a photon torpedo. You know, I just judge and sit up there on the throne, you know, like Captain Kirk, and run the universe. And I don't know I'm running the universe. I used to go to Dick when I was new. I don't talk to my sponsor when I'm a little angst, because I'm the kind of guy that will drive on a flat tire. I think it goes away. So what happened? It's like I want help. I just need to look like I don't need it. You know what I mean? And it's hard to get help and look like you don't need it at the same time. It's an art form, I'm telling you. And so what I would do is I'd try to think this stuff's going to go away, or I'm going to live with it. And then it would build up because resentments and fears are, it's like a cancer. It just spreads. The next thing you know, you got a whole bunch of people that you're angry at. You got a whole bunch of stuff you're afraid of and worrying about until you're spinning in your head. And I would go to him, and I got a whole bushel basket of stuff, and I'd start telling him things that are making me nuts. And some of it, I don't want to tell you, because some of it's childish and pathetic and petty. You know, but I got to tell him. So I start telling him about the people in the AA meeting that drink 4 cups of coffee and don't put any money in the basket, because I count. I mean, I'm counting. The guy selling Amway in the parking lot after the meeting. The 13 steppers. Oh, they really aggravated me. Dick told me, he said, you're just pissed they're getting more action than you are. That's all. Don't bother me with the truth. You know, I'm talking about the guys at work that come in late and they do all that. And he'd always say the same thing to me. He'd always say, you've got to quit playing God. I think, I'm not playing God. I'm reporting accurate information here. I'm not playing God. You know, isn't that bizarre? I do this all my life. I'm the guy who has the noticer, just notices. I play God all my life. I'm better when I'm drinking. I'm more tolerant. But sober, I play God, and I don't know that I'm doing it. I don't know that I'm doing it. I don't know that I automatically, because I'm scared, I have to grandize myself above the herd, because the herd threatens the crap out of me. And I get up here on the throne of judgment, and I just live there. And guys like me, we're very lucky to stay here, because what happens when you have an ego like that is you will literally judge yourself right out of Alcoholics Anonymous, one person at a time. And what might keep you in here for years is your self-grandizement. You know, you develop your little AA resume. That you kind of, when somebody shares something in the meeting you don't like, you beat them over the head with it. Well, I was this, I was that. How many meetings do you go to? And my ego started to return. And when I was brand new, I had been surrendered by the bottle. And I didn't know that. But on my last run, I tried to take my own life. I'd been relapsing for about 7 years. And I just got to that place it talks about in Vision for You, where I can't imagine life with it. Because it had turned on me, and it was horrible, and it was pathetic. And I'm desperately trying to jumpstart a party that won't jumpstart. And now I drink and I cry and feel sorry for myself. I drink and call up people I went to kindergarten with one at 4 a.m., you know, and our ex-girlfriends at 3 in the morning and crying to the phone, we should have gotten married, you know. Oh, my parents, I had wonderful parents. I mean, I had a wonderful, idyllic childhood by parents that weren't alcoholic that loved me. And I tried to pin everything wrong with me on them, and they never did anything except love me and try to help me and provide, worked hard to provide me with opportunities in later years, counselors and probation fines and all kinds of stuff. And I called my mom and dad up one time about 3 or 4 in the morning, crying into the phone about how you must have raised me wrong. I'm so messed up. You know, what must it have been like to try to love someone like me? Must have been brutal. And I don't know what's wrong with me. I have no idea. People, a couple rehabs sort of half sold me on this idea that it was alcoholism because of what happens to me when I start to drink. But then I became very convinced that it wasn't alcoholism because I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and I would sit in the middle of the rooms and I knew by observation and listening that whatever's wrong with me, for God's sakes, is not the same thing that's wrong with you. I don't know what's wrong with me. But I look at you and I listen to you and you're wonderful. You quit drinking and you're grateful for everything. Oh my God, I don't even like anything. I don't like me. I don't like life. I mean, you guys quit drinking and you love everybody. Oh, just stop it. Stop it. Shoot me. Oh. I just sit in these halfway houses, and you'd come in, and you just smack me with a series of miracle stories of how wonderful you're. My life is crap, and I have to listen to you tell me, rub my face in how wonderful you have it. And it seemed like to me, you guys drank a little bit too much, and you came to AA, and you found God, and now you're the president of United States Steel or something. You know, it's a crazy thing. And I'm trying to figure out who I can bum a cigarette off of. Jeez. So I watched you and I listened to you and I get it. That I got a problem and alcohol's in the picture, but it's not alcoholism. Because I quit drinking and there's something else very wrong with me. And I don't know what it is. And my mother, God bless her, my dad and mom both, my mother worked for mental health and was very connected in that deal. And my dad was very politically connected. And they got me in to see, and some of the absolute greatest therapists on the planet. I mean, guys, you had to be a movie star. I used to go up to New York City and I was in therapy for a while with a guy who wrote all these books at an institute up there. He had one in California. He was like a big shot. I was in therapy with a guy who studied under Alan Watts and Fritz Perls. I mean, these are amazing men. But I don't have mental illness. I have something more hideous. I have a spiritual malady. And the good news in Alcoholics Anonymous, if I treat that and make that the piece of business in my life, the book promises me that when the spiritual malady is overcome, I will straighten out mentally and physically. And that has been true for me. And I bet my life on it. And I went to some psychiatrists, some very good psychiatrists that misdiagnosed me. I've been diagnosed as panic disorder, free-floating anxiety, which you get a little better meds for that than some of the other diagnoses. Stuff like Valium and, you know, that's not bad. I've been diagnosed as clinically depressed, but it's not really clinical depression. I've read the pages, the diagnostic stuff. It looks like it really, truly does. But it's what I have is what the big book talks about. I have a sickness that when I quit drinking, I just get so obsessively involved and focused on me. I get myself on me, like that creature in that movie Alien that attaches itself to your face. How you doing, Bob? Oh, I'm hanging in there. And my very soul feels like it's being smothered here. Like somebody stepped on the oxygen hose to my being. Isn't it funny? You're 6, 8, 10 months sober with untreated alcoholism, and your spirit's sick. We all do the same thing. The first double shot, we all go, like somebody turned the air back on. Like I can finally breathe again. Like my spirit's starting to get free, because when I get sober, I just get locked up in me and my emotions and my thoughts and my future. And I don't know about you, I check my future obsessively and it never looks good. I have never sat down for 20 minutes and just pondered myself and came away joyous. When I start thinking about me, I do not spiral upward. I spiral downward every single time. And it's brutal. Silkworth says it very well. He says, guys like me, we quit drinking, we become restless. You know that feeling like wherever you are, it's not really where you need to be. I don't know where I need to be, but it's not here. I'm irritable, but I don't want to admit that I'm irritable, because I don't like irritable people. They irritate me. Really, I don't like irritable people. They're pain. I don't like fear. So I'm not irritable. But when I quit drinking, I so clearly see how stupid people are. Do you know what I mean? I work with stupid people. They look like nice people when I went to work there. They're stupid people. Everywhere I ever get a job, they're stupid people. I drive in traffic. Oh, with stupid people. Oh, my God. I get in the grocery store. Stupid. Did you ever watch what some people buy in the grocery store? Stupid people. Some of the stuff they're buying is stupid people. Stupid people. I'm made to go to AA meetings. Oh, my God. They got the stupid people group here. Oh, my God. I just sit there and listen to you guys. Oh my God, half of you sound like Hallmark cards from a recovery bookstore. The other half are just lying. I don't know what to say. I mean, you're just making up stuff. I mean, stupid people. They're trying to sell me something. I don't know what you're trying to sell me. It's some kind of religious app or something. I don't know what it is. Stupid people. And the last symptom, Silkworth says, are chronically malcontent. I'm discontented. Jeff talked about it a little bit last night. It was a great talk Jeff gave last night. And that there's something about me that I can't really, truly ever get satisfied. No matter, I'm the guy who gets the best girlfriend I've ever had. I mean the girlfriend I know with her. Oh, my God. And 6 weeks later, it's like, God, was I wrong about her? I get that job in that steel mill, man. I got a job at J&O. This steel mill, this was an amazing job. I knew if I ever could get a job like this, I would be there. This was own a boat, have a Harley, own a house kind of money. This was a big deal. And I had that job. Oh, my God, I'm not even there 3 weeks. Stupid people running that mill. Oh, my God. And I'm the guy the problem is I'm the guy that's leaving. I'm always the guy that's leaving. And I'm always the guy that's alone. I'm right, but I'm leaving and I'm alone. And alcoholism is a lonely, lonely business. In 1978, when I stood on that bridge, it didn't feel like it was alcoholism. If I could have been honest about how I really felt and what was going on inside of me, I might have told you that I felt like I was dying of loneliness, because I don't fit anywhere drunk, and I used to. and I don't fit anywhere sober, and there was a time, and I don't know why. I don't know why I can't belong anywhere. Well, there was a time when, oh my God, there was a time when alcohol just set me free. There was a time when alcohol connected me with people with a level of intimacy that was just amazing. I used to run with a bunch in the early days, in the magic days of drinking. I ran with a gang of guys, man. We'd get drunk and we were like this, man. I remember we'd say things to each other like, "I'd die for you, man." You know, wow, that's pretty amazing for a guy who doesn't even fit and can't even talk to anybody. That's a really very cool. Alcohol allowed me to talk to girls. Oh. I tell you, not to be crude, but if it wasn't for alcohol, I'd probably be celibate to this day. I mean, I remember the fear in junior high school and in high school that was just overwhelming. It would literally lock me up going to dances sober. I remember I went to this one dance, and there was a girl in my class I was obsessed with. I've never talked to her. Matter of fact, she makes me so crazy. Not only can't I talk to her, I can't even look on that side of the room when she's over there. She makes me nuts. And I'm going to go to this dance, and I'm going to ask her to dance. I already know what school our kids are going to go to. I mean, it's like, I build like castles in the air, you know what I mean? And I'm looking for somebody to decorate them. So I go to this dance, and I'm going to ask her to dance, and I can't. And I must have been 5-6 songs. Every song I'm trying to psych myself up for the next song. I can't do it. I felt like such a pathetic loser. And I shuffled out of that gymnasium and out to the parking lot and ran into a couple buddies of mine that had some 151 rum. Any 151 rum drinkers in here? Just, if you're new and you're still a little delusional, I want to let you in on a little truth. There is no social drinking of 151 rum. Let's get that real clear, okay? All right. There's no social drinking of Everclear either. But I love 151, because 151 rum gets you like a rocket. Ooh, I love that stuff. And I had a couple rum and cokes out in that parking lot. I came floating back into that dance under the power of 151 rum. Just kind of floated over to her. Just started talking to her. It was amazing. Words are coming out of my mouth. I don't know where they're coming from. I'm like channeling someone here. This is amazing. I remember at one point watching her face, and she's laughing, and she's really interested, and thinking to myself, oh my God, this could work. It was amazing where it was coming from. And then what happens? You know what happens. You know what always happens. You sober up and you're back to being you again. And I never liked that much. And that's my big secret. See, alcohol spoiled me. It gave me a glory and a majesty and a connectedness and almost a godlike participation in life. And when it turned on me and stopped doing all those things for me, when it stopped setting me free, and now I drink it and I'm just as much a prisoner in my own emotions and in myself as I was when I was sober, if only now I'm rummy and I'm pathetic. What a horrible place to be. For those of us that have touched the sky, oh my God, we've been there. And now it's this. The book says you got to a place where you can't imagine life with it, not like this. And yet I can't imagine life without it either, because abstinence is such a desolate place for me. I'm a depressive person, abstinence. I'm a thinker. I'm a guy who doesn't fit anywhere sober. And I'll try to make it out to be your fault, you know. Everyone I don't feel like I fit with, I'll pick you apart, I'll make fun of you, I'll do something to try to justify this horrible separateness that everything in me just would like to be a part of. The loneliness is overwhelming. And so I drink, and I get sober, and I drink. And in 1978, I tried to kill myself. 1977, I ended up in an emergency room. This is leading back to me killing myself. And I end up in emergency rooms frequently. I hurt myself sometimes when I'm drunk. You know, just weird stuff. Like I'll fall down and break something, or I'll put my fist through an alcoholic rage through a window and can't stop bleeding or something. And I'm in this emergency room, and they give me a couple stitches, and they've x-rayed me. Now I got to sit there and wait for the results of the x-ray. So I've been in there a couple hours. And so I'm kind of sobered up in there. And I'm sitting in the waiting room waiting for the doctor to call me back in again. And there's this rack of medical pamphlets, stuff like heart disease and diabetes. And there's one pamphlet kind of gets my attention. It says the 7 warning signs of cancer. And I grab this pamphlet and I start reading through it. And one of the warning signs of cancer is continued unexplained bleeding. Well, I get dry heaves and blood comes out often. Matter of fact, there are some times I'm bleeding out both ends. And I just thought, oh my God, I got cancer. And then I had this epiphany. Oh my, it was like an awakening. I thought, oh my God, it's metastasized into my brain. That explained volumes of my life. It explained why I do weird things and I can't remember them. Any blackout drinkers in here? Oh, my people. Oh, it's hard going through life when other people know more about you than you do. I mean, and I don't know about you. I've never done anything good in a blackout. No one ever came up to me the next day and said, oh, Bob, you were so helpful last night. No, it's like, you peed in our kitchen. You threw up in my living room. You broke my lamp. You passed out on my front lawn. You stole my stash. You hit on my wife. You sideswiped my car. I remember the most hideous thing I ever did. I don't remember, but I was early in the morning. I was sick and I had the shakes. I needed a drink. I needed a bottle of Richard's Wild Irish Rose. Bad. Bad. And I'm on my way to that liquor store that doesn't open until 10 a.m. And I've got to get down there at 9:30 and walk back and forth in front of the windows. And if you look pathetic enough, hoping they open early, they never open early. And on the way to the liquor store, this guy cuts into me. And he says to me, you know you told everybody last night you beat Bruce Lee in a karate match? Oh, shoot me. You know, and so I can't get drunk quick enough, and you start in that cycle where I'm drinking over my drinking, right? And through this, and through all the therapy and all the intermittent ending up in hospitals and detoxes and treatment centers, I got people coming out of the woodwork trying to give me advice. I got people coming at me from everywhere trying to help me, but I'm hard to help. And if you're reasonably new here, or maybe not so new, chances are that by the time you got here, there have been some people getting in your face, talking to you about you. Maybe your mother and father have had conversations with you about you. Maybe your spouse or your mate or your boyfriend or your girlfriend has had conversations with you about, maybe your kids, maybe your minister, maybe your priest, maybe your PO. If you get really bad, maybe your drug dealer's been talking to you about you. You get real bad, strangers on the street start talking to you about you. And they all use different words. It's all different stuff. But it's all kind of the same thing, isn't it? Really, they're all saying, Bob, you're really screwed up. And if you catch me on a bad day, when my defense mechanisms are down, I'll probably agree with you. I'll probably, yeah, I know. I'm sorry, I know. And they'll say, you know why you're so screwed up? By this time, I've been to so much therapy, I have no idea. No. Well, they say, you know, the reason you're screwed up is you keep getting screwed up. If you didn't keep getting screwed up, you wouldn't be so screwed up. And so I'm pretty screwed up. I think, okay, I'll stop getting screwed up. And when I stop getting screwed up, I am so screwed up, I have to go get screwed up. And some guy says, you know, you're screwed up. And I go, yeah, I know, I know. You know why you're screwed up? Because I keep getting screwed up. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me, because I think alcoholism is contained in a bottle. But alcoholism doesn't come in bottles, it comes in people. And for all practical purposes, if you're a chronic alcoholic, and you're like me, your alcoholism starts where the bottle ends. I mean, for God's sakes, why do you think people who have everything to lose and swear to themselves and mean it that they're never going to drink again, why do you think we drink again? Because of a disease called alcoholism. And I got it. I was over in Russia a couple years ago, doing a weekend over there, a little conference. It was odd because nobody there, only two people out of 150 or 70 people spoke English. So we had an interpreter do everything. And this guy, during one of the breaks, was very excited. And he came running up to me. He had to talk to me. And he's telling me the story about the Soviet Union before it collapsed. And Russia has had one of the most horrific alcoholism problems you'd ever seen. I mean, they got it in spades over there, really bad. And this guy's telling me that right before the Soviets collapsed, one of their last-ditch efforts to curtail this problem that was making their society almost dysfunctional was that their scientists had come up with a chip. And if you were a chronic offender, they would surgically implant this chip into the muscle tissue in the middle of your back. And if you drank again, the chip detected it, and it would release this toxic poison into your bloodstream that must have been like super anabuse. And if you weren't in good shape, it could kill you. And if it didn't kill you, you're going to wish you were dead for about 2 days. And as he's telling me that, he pulls his shirt up and he turns around and he's got this ugly scar in the middle of his back where after a year with the chip of abstinence, he begged his best friend to take a kitchen knife and cut the chip out of him so he can go get some relief, for God's sakes. Now that sounds bizarre. I'm telling you, I'm the guy looking for somebody to cut the chip out because of a disease called alcoholism. And it just works on me and drives me insane. Slowly cooks me in my own juices. And in 1970, I'm in this hospital, and I'm imagining, I see this pamphlet, and I'm imagining I got a brain tumor. And it would explain a whole lot. And I, for months, I had this fantasy that, you know, one of these days, they're going to pull me off the streets and they're going to take me to the cancer ward and they're going to realize I've had a brain tumor all this time. And of course they're going to notify my mother and father, who had thought I was a bum. And my mother and father are instantly going to realize how wrong they'd been about me, come running to the hospital to beg my forgiveness. They're going to have to notify all my ex-girlfriends, who all thought I was a worthless nothing. And they're all going to realize, oh my God, Bob, you had a brain tumor. We didn't know. And they'd come and beg my forgiveness. And if they were properly ashamed of themselves, I suppose I could dish out a little forgiveness. And I loved that fantasy. It just made me feel all kind of good inside, just thinking about that feeling. I ended up in a detox. And I'm telling this doctor, I said, doc. I know you think it's alcoholism, but really, doc, I have a brain tumor. And he says to me, was this verified? And I said, yes, it was. It was verified by the smartest guy I know. So he got into this deal and he gave me a whole series of tests. I mean, he tested everything. He comes back to me and he says, you don't have a cancer, a brain tumor. You've got an ulcer and a hemorrhoid. This is the pathetic part. I was disappointed and wanted a second opinion. Right? Now, if you have the kind of ego that would rather have you dead and have them wrong and you right, you do not have a high mental health quotient. But one of the things the doctor told me, he said, I was a young kid, I was in my 20s, and he said, kid, you know, if you keep drinking, it's going to kill you. But it might, you're young enough and healthy enough physically, it might take 5 more years. I came to in a park, and I don't know how many days I've been into this run. And I get it. I get that all the fun is out of this thing. It's pathetic. And I will never, ever, ever get it back to the fun days. This pathetic drinking is as good as it gets. And I can't go on like this. And I remember him saying, 5 more years. And I remember sinking into this abyss and just thinking to myself, no, sir, I'm not doing 5 more days of this. And I made up my mind to kill myself. And I went to a bridge in Pittsburgh that was about 100 feet down to these railroad tracks below. It was right near the river. And I'm standing on this bridge, and I made the decision to kill myself. And I got to tell you something, in the decision was some relief. I felt better knowing I was going to get this over with. And I get to that bridge, and it's time to leap. And a fear grips me. And it's not the fear of dying. I'm not afraid of dying. People have been telling me for years I keep doing this, eventually going to kill you. Yeah, by Wednesday. What I'm afraid of is living. What you want to scare me, have a mind that looks down 100 feet below and says things to you like, you know, Bob, with your track record, you're probably going to screw this up like everything else. What if this isn't high enough? What if you just break your back or your neck and you end up paralyzed from the neck down in some charity ward? And because you're a young guy, you're going to lay there and be forced into sobriety, laying there for 50 years, listening to your head tell you what a piece of crap you are, while members of Alcoholics Anonymous parade their newcomers through the room. And you get to hear them say things like, well, this is what happens to you when you don't work our beautiful 12 steps. And I'm paralyzed. I can't even give them a one-finger salute. And I couldn't kill myself because I really am a coward. I've always been a coward. And I didn't know that I would end up off that run in a detox in Las Vegas, Nevada, 2,000 miles away. I'd run in from the law and all alone. Or I'd meet this gentleman sitting right down here. And other members of a group that became my home group, and they were the doers. It's funny, if you're in a detox or a treatment center and the people from AA come in there, you probably don't realize who you're dealing with. This is the cream of the crop here. Alcoholics Anonymous is the only organization on the planet that I know of where you come in a big shot and you work your way up to servant. And these were the servants. These were the people that believed, not in by verbal patronage, but believed by their actions in the primary purpose. They knew that they were saved from an alcoholic death, not to have be wonderful, but so that they could spend the rest of their life looking for people just like them. And they got me. And I went up to this guy. I said to him, I said, would you sponsor me? And I said, if you'll sponsor me, I'll do everything you ask me to do. They got lists of stuff. Oh, yeah. Oh, I just thought it was being nice saying that. No, they have stuff they want you to do. I mean, they got a lot of stuff they want you to do. And none of it seems like a good idea until after you do it. And the amazing thing is when people gave me suggestions, for the most part, I just did them. A lot of them I didn't want to do. A guy told me I had to contact Pennsylvania and offer to go clear that up and go to prison if necessary. The amazing thing is I did it. When people in Alcoholics Anonymous told me I had to contact my parents and make amends, I tried to explain to them that it's too late. They won't even take my calls. And you know what they said? They said, don't call collect. It's funny. I would have never thought of that. Isn't that odd? I would have never thought of that. And I was in a group of people that really believed in service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was a secretary of a meeting before I was, wasn't even sober long enough. I tried to object. They changed the rules. I was about 2.5, 3 months sober. I was secretary of a meeting. I was an assistant GSR with less than a year, co-GSR. And then the GSR quit, so I was a GSR with about a year sober. Same thing happened with DCM. I spent 2 terms as GSR, 2 terms as DCM. I was involved with General Service for a lot of years. Stood for delegate, went to the hat. I love the hat. I really love the hat. God shows up in the hat. God doesn't always express himself in a group conscience because sometimes group consciences are uninformed. But he expresses himself in the hat, and I didn't get it. And a woman named Louise Robertson got it, and she should have got it. She was a good delegate. She was good for the Nevada area. And I started going on 12-step calls when I was brand new. They wanted me to take meetings back into the detox I just came out of. They wanted me to sign up for the meetings that were going to be started at Gene Prison. All this stuff. This guy, they just seemed it. They had like a one-track mind. Help people, service, help people, help people. And, you know, I had a lot of psychiatric background, and I tried to explain to this one guy one time. I said, you know, don't you think I should work on me for a while? And he reared back. He said, work on you. You've done quite enough of that. Stop it. Stop it. And I thought, I didn't get mad. I thought, you know, I have done quite enough of that. I mean, if I could have been fixed, I'd have been fixed by now. I mean, I don't know anybody that's ever sought relief and treatment for me like I've done. That's why I love that delusion in the book that talks about we're victims of the delusion that we can wrest happiness and satisfaction out of this world if we only manage well. The reason that's a delusion is, for God's sakes, look around you. What demographic on the planet has ever spent more money, more energy, more obsessive focus on making themselves happy and satisfied as we have, and the end result is, will you sponsor me? I mean, you get that. Here's the worst delusion of them all. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed. And what happens behind that is that I start taking all these surrendered actions. I start doing what you're telling me to do. And then incrementally and slowly the ego returns. And my ego's hideous. It will use everything I learn in AA to grandize itself, to promote itself, to gratify itself, to set itself up above. It will take service positions and try to make them all about me with a spotlight. It will take everything that's decent in Alcoholics Anonymous in my life and make something kind of squirmy out of it. I did a service manual study group for a while, concepts in service manual. I learned a lot about the traditions. But I got to tell you, honest to God, I didn't learn it to be a better, more effective, useful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think truly I learned some of that stuff so I could go to meetings and look for tradition breaks. When I found one, it was like Christmas. So I could lord my knowledge over you. I started doing big book stuff, and God, I was a hideous guy with that stuff because my ego grabbed onto it. Of course it did. Of course it did. See, I don't know. Harry Thiebaud said something brilliant. He talked about the amazing recuperative powers of the alcoholic ego. Guys like me can be crushed and squashed and broken. And like a phoenix rising out of the ashes, the ego grows back. And it grows back smarter and stronger and cleverer. Now it's armed with information from the big book. Pathetic. See, here's my nature. I'm like the back of a toilet tank. You can flush me and I'll just empty out of me and I just start filling up with me again. I don't mean to. It's just the nature of the beast. You can flush me every day, and by an hour later, I'm full of me. It's just the nature of it. And I started hitting some little other surrenders in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, we used to talk years ago about the second surrender. There's more than two, but you know, I think some of us would come here and we're surrendered by the bottle. And then in our abstinence, as active members of Alcoholics Anonymous, if we survive ourselves, we're surrendered by life itself and my absolute inability to manage my own life sober, even with good intentions, that I can't run the show, that I am here to do my Father's business. And basically, that's to help his kids. My life is never better than when I'm forgetting myself and thinking about you and helping you. I sponsor quite a few guys. Sometimes people ask me, how many people do you sponsor? The truth is, I don't know. But I tell you, every time they ask me that, I have one answer. And I just think of myself for about 10 seconds and go, not enough. Not enough. It takes a lot of service. I am for a guy like me to be relieved of the bondage of self. I'm the guy that Bill Wilson talks about in the book when he says our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others, their needs, and how we can work for them. Bill says something that's really has been true for me. He says, unless a guy like me can perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through two things, and oddly enough, it is not prayer and meditation. It's self-sacrifice and working with others. Unless I can do that, the only way a guy like me can perfect and enlarge my spiritual life is I've got to shrink me. You want to grow God in your life? Shrink you. And Alcoholics Anonymous has been in my life a program of self-reduction. You know, one of the most beautiful things that happened to me, I didn't work the fourth step out of the big book. Now, I did two fourth steps in my first 4 years or so of sobriety, but I didn't work the fourth step out of the big book until I was over 4 years sober. So when I start putting together this long resentment list, most of the people on the list are people in AA. Right? And a lot of it's really pathetic, childish kind of resentments. You know, 3 years ago he had a party and didn't personally invite me. You know, squirmy, childish stuff. And then I had some cases built on people that I'll tell you, I was right about certain people. Matter of fact, I'm not just right. I can go around to meetings and get other people to see how I'm right about them. Which ends up on my ninth step, eighth step list, actually. And the book had me, you know, it's brilliant. If you've ever read the account of how Bill Wilson wrote chapter 5, he had writer's block, he was stumped, and he went into a lot of prayer and meditation. Then he said, he picked the pen up, and it just had a life of its own as it went across the page. I believe with everything in me, God wrote that book, especially chapter 5. There's stuff in there Bill Wilson didn't even know. He'd never experienced it. And here we have a guy like me. I'm asked to make a list of all my resentments, all my judgments, really. Everything I think I'm right about. You know, what is your resentment list? Isn't it really a list of everyone, if there was any justice, would owe you an amends? Kinda. I mean, you know. It's everybody that's wrong. It's all the stupid people. You put them all down, and there's a lot of them. You put them all down. The books, there's a place in our literature that we're bound to make a long list. All the stupid people. And then what? I put down what was hurt, threatened, affected, injured, interfered with. Next to the little bullet points of what they did. And then it asked me to do something that's miraculous. It's asking you to change my mind about those people. The book says it a little different. It says we were prepared to look at these things from an entirely different angle. I spent my whole life looking at my judgments as if I was a prosecuting attorney. And now you're asking me to look at them from an entirely different angle, to get up and cross that courtroom and sit on that other, that defense table and start having a dialogue from their point of view. Now, I don't know anything about your personal resentments, but I'll bet you one thing. I'll bet you the story the person you resent tells about what happened between you and them and the story you tell are different stories. Now, the ego naturally rears right up and says, yeah, but my story's right. Hey, if you've got the kind of track record that I got, what are the chances of that? And I started to dismantle, and this was our course, as I started to make that vital realization, I started to realize how wrong I'd been in every single case. I can't imagine anything that's more ego reducing than to make a list of all your judgments and then be wrong about every single one of them. And they trick you. They don't tell you that everybody that you think owes you an amends on your resentment list, you're going to end up going to them. Oh, if they told you that, you probably wouldn't write your fourth step. But everybody on my resentment list, I was in separation from. And the amends aren't. Amends is not about right or wrong. It's about the restoration of love. All the ego's in the right or wrong business, but the soul yearns for connectivity. It yearns for oneness. It yearns to return to love. And so everyone I was separate, in a state of separation from, I had to amend the break between me and them. And a lot of people did a lot more wrong to me than I did to them, but they didn't have the tools to mend the break, and I did. So it was in my lap to take the action. And I started to get some, for the first time in my life, some little bit of ego reduction, and it's funny how I think that was when I started to develop a sense of humor. You know, the word humor and the word humility come from the same root word, humus or earth. I started to come down to earth enough. I wasn't up in the control center as much. I started to come down to earth enough to start to get the joke. And the joke is me. How silly I am. How silly all this little childish, pathetic judgments are. How silly the whole thing is. I started to get the joke. I've had a license plate on my car now for, 20 some years, says Rule 62. I think it's one of the best. One of the symptoms of the resurgence of ego is seriousness. And you all know that. When you're running the show, when you're playing God, when you're ego dominant, things are heavy. Serious. Serious. Prior to doing that fourth step, I had a guy accuse me of having my sense of humor surgically removed at a meeting. I've had some beautiful teachers. There was a guy, Dale, and Dale got in my face one time. And Dale said to me, he says, kid, I want you to know some things. And if you'll buy what I'm about to tell you, you're going to save yourself a lot of pain and a lot of grief. He said, kid, I want you to know that if you're explaining something, if you're justifying something, if you're defending something or rationalizing something, kid, I want you to know you're wrong. Because you never will have to explain, justify, rationalize, or justify what's right. That was 30-some years ago. I tell you, I've not found an exception to that yet. It is the ego that is self-justifying. And you know, the problem with self-justification is self. The problem with self-aggrandizement is self. The problem with self-promotion. I see people in Alcoholics Anonymous doing self-promotion. Like they write a book and then they want to sell it in AA, or they want to give their speaker tapes to people so they'll have them. If you understand that self is the enemy, self-promotion is like arming the Al-Qaeda. I mean, you're feeding something that should be starved, and maybe you're starving something that should be fed. See, I have a disease of self. If I ever leave Alcoholics Anonymous, it'll be because I'll be puffed up on me and judgmental of you. I'll probably slide out of here one judgment at a time. One compromised action at a time. Oh yeah, I was the guy years ago that did all the AA stuff, but I'm too busy anymore. I've had conversations with people that that I know are in trouble. I don't know what it is. I got this, the last few years, I seem to end up sponsoring a whole bunch of people sober a long time that are in a lot of trouble. And I'll tell you something, my heart goes out to them, because if you're 20 days sober and you drink again, it's horrible. We hope you never ever do that. But statistically, you've got a pretty good shot at coming back and finding lifelong sobriety. You're 20 years sober and you drink again, statistically, you're in a lot of trouble. And we're losing the people that are sober a long time. And they don't even know what's killing them, that they've filled up with themselves again. And they've compromised their actions. And you don't compromise recovery like that. It's not like a light switch. It's incremental. Niche by niche. Compromised act. Dropping commitments. Dropping. You start saying things when people say, you want to go on a 12-step call. Oh, I've done a lot of that. This year? This month? Let the newer people do it. It almost as if their actions are speaking something. That their actions are saying, no matter what their mouth says, their actions are saying, well, I surely don't have as much alcoholism as I did when I first got sober. And alcoholism is unforgiving. I got to tell you something. It doesn't care. And it's progressive. And the book says something hideous. And I've watched this. It says that over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. While we're here helping people in some other dimension, my alcoholism is progressing and getting stronger. And you know how you know that? If you've been around a long time, you probably had the experience of watching 12-stepping a guy. He gets sober. You really know where he's at. You know where he's at emotionally, mentally, physically, financially, his relationships. You know the level of his despair and hopelessness. And then he stays sober 15, 20 years and he drinks again. He does not pick up where he left off. The disease has progressed. If he just picked up where he left off, he'd have a chance of getting back here. But the problem is these people can't understand why they're doing what they worked 20 years ago and it's not enough anymore, because the disease of alcoholism is up the ante here. And you know what progresses the most? It's the ego. I work with a lot of guys like that, and they become the I know guys. You try to talk to them, they go, yeah, I know, Yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. I know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I often suspect they're really saying, shut up. Shut up. Leave me alone. Or maybe they really do know intellectually, but none of this occurs here. We start with step one when it says we had to fully concede to our innermost self. This is where this has to happen. That's why you can have a head full of information. I watched a man. Take my remember, they called him Family George. He could get up to the podium without opening a book, recite chapter 3, chapter 5, A Vision for You. He knew more about the big book, the steps, the traditions, than anyone I've ever known. And he could not stay sober because he had it all up here and nothing in here, and consequently nothing in his feet. Because this really is and always will be an action program. It doesn't matter what I believe, it doesn't matter how I feel, and it doesn't matter what I think. It only matters what I do. And Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a man who used to come over here who was helping me a lot, and some of you might remember Frank Honeycutt. Frank was a stellar member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Frank used to say that, that Alcoholics Anonymous is not for those who need it, and we all know that's true. And it's not even for those who want it. I've watched men sitting outside the detox against the big oak tree that are dying of this disease, hoping to get a bed, and they're coming apart at the seams, and they will tell you, sobbing with tears in their eyes, how much they want this, and they never get it. Because Frank said it's only for those who do it. But the beauty of that is that I don't have to become anything other than what I am. All I got to do is take the actions. I just have to follow these old timers around and do what they do. And if I do what they do, I get what they get. It really is and always will be an action program. I'll tell you one little quick story and I'll shut it down. I heard a guy share this in 1980. I've never forgotten it. It is the best description of Alcoholics Anonymous. This story, I've shared it a lot. This guy heard this from a guy named Clancy. And he was talking about alcoholism. He said, when you hit a bottom, it's kind of like being shipwrecked at sea, and you're hundreds and hundreds of miles from land, and you're treading water out in the middle of the ocean, and you're dying. And he said, about the time where you can't tread any more water, here come two goofy-looking idiots pretending they're rowing across the top of the water. There's not even anything there. And they kind of come right up to you, and they say, my name's Bill. My name's Bob. We're from Alcoholics Anonymous. We've got God and these beautiful 12 steps, and they'll solve all your problems. And you go, get away from me. You guys are nuts. Get out of here. Leave me alone, man. I'm dying here. Leave me alone. You're crazy. Get away from me. And they row off. About the time you're about ready to go down for the last count, over the ocean, over the horizon comes this big chrome ocean liner. It says treatment center on the side. Oh my God, they got psychiatrists and they got psychologists and they got medications and they got members of the opposite sex and they got vocational rehabilitation specialists and biofeedback technicians. And oh my God, you know, you suspect a person of your depth and complexity would need all of that. You can't get help from a construction worker and a plumber and a pretend boat, for God's sakes. You need all this. And you get on board, and it's wonderful, man. You go to group, and you're cracking the secrets of your emotion, and you're ventilating, and it's just spectacular. And you have whole rooms full of people just discussing the most important thing in the world, me. Your therapist in an office for an hour talking about me. And it's beautiful. And I love it. And I'm learning. And I'm puffed up with enough knowledge that I think I got this thing now. I understand. I get it. And just about the time you know you got it, over the side. And you're treading water, holding your graduation ship as the ocean liner goes off to sea. And there you are. And about the time you're about ready to go down for the last time, here come those two assholes in that visible boat. My name's Bill. My name's Bob. We're from Alcoholics Anonymous. We've got God and these wonderful 12 steps. Solve all your problems. And you go, oh, God, not you guys. Oh, this is terrible. It's got to be somebody else. No, you don't have nothing. And if you're very lucky, they pull you on board. And there you are, sitting on top of the water. And you don't know how you're sitting there, as some of us have sat in meetings at 8 and 10 months sober and realized that we're sober longer than we'd ever been since the first time we picked up a drink. And we don't know how that happened. And you say to them, what do I do? And they say, row. Row? There's not even any oars. They say, no, just do like we do. Just go like this. And you feel stupid, and there you are. And a funny thing happens. The more you row that boat, the more substantial it becomes. And in time, it becomes so solid you could break dance in that sucker. And then if you're very unfortunate, maybe after 10 years of being solid and comfortable and secure in that boat, you're so secure that you quit rowing and it immediately starts to disappear. If you're new, come and join us. Grab an oar. follow the old timers around. You may be lucky enough to know a great truth, and the great truth is, what the hell do you got to lose? Thanks for listening.